are those who believe that life here began out there, far across the universe, with tribes of humans who may have been the forefathers of the Egyptians, or the Toltecs, or the Mayans. Some believe that there may yet be brothers of man who even now fight to survive somewhere beyond the heavens.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today's topic is the classic Battlestar Galactica from 1978-79. And joining me to discuss it is our old friend of the show, Jim Yelton. How you doing, Jim?
Hey, Van. How's it going?
Glad to have you back aboard again. You may now be our most recurring guest.
You know what's funny? When you said that, I think you're right, because I was looking at the list the other day, and it seems like that's true.
Well, and it's well-deserved. And it's always fun to talk to you and with you about these cool pop culture topics. Tell the folks again that are just now tuning in, maybe for the first time, who you are and where they can find your stuff.
Well, much like you, I'm a writer. I've also done a lot of stage work. I'm a director of various theatrical productions. But where most of your listeners would probably be interested in finding me is at midnight-entertainment.com. Mm-hmm. That's my website with all the books and various stories and stuff. And actually, it just got updated recently, so there's a preview of our upcoming superhero series Extraordinary on there. I think the whole first chapter is on there, so people can go check that out.
Awesome. Great. Yeah, I did stop by. It looks really good the other day. That's awesome.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Let's see. So we want to jump right in and talk about that 1978-79 show. Let's kind of go back. I'm assuming, you know, usually I ask kind of how did you get into something when I'm talking with a guest, but I'm assuming that like me, you were in it from the start.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Cause you and I are both roughly same age. Mm-hmm. So it was like right in our wheelhouse,
yeah.
You know, coming out of Star Wars in 77. So, mm-hmm. You know, Galactica came out in 78 and yeah, day one, I watched the premiere. It was great.
And, yeah, before we even get into that, I always have to tell the little story that I remember. It's funny because I teach, one of the classes I teach is Middle East history,
And I always tell them when we get to the when I get to the Camp David Accords, I always say, in the Camp David Accords, the agreement happened on September 17th, 1978. And I know that they happened on September 17th, 1978, because they interrupted Battlestar Galactica's premiere episode to tell us. And this was one more reason why I was mad at Jimmy Carter. He couldn't wait till Monday to do it. He had to do it on Sunday night, prime time, in the middle of the debut episode, the 3 hour. I mean,
yeah, well, and that's what I was going to say, because I remember, you know, all the promotion leading up to it. I mean, that whole Sunday night was Battlestar Galactica, because the show was 3 hours that night.
That's just amazing.
And then even when they interrupted it for the news about the Accords being signed, it wasn't like, you know, a normal interruption where we'll just pick up the show already in progress. Like, they stopped it.
Yeah. And that was smart.
And when the news was over and they picked it back up, they started where it stopped before the break. So you didn't miss any of the story or anything. And I remember, you know, thinking back on it, that's how big of a deal this was for ABC, that they would do something like that. Right. I mean, they extended the show, you know, past the 10 o'clock, you know, time that it would have run.
But, you know, the weird thing about that, you're absolutely right. But the thing that's so funny is that for all these years, I've always thought that they didn't, because, and I, going back and watching, I've watched the first half of the pilot again. I didn't have a chance to do more than that. It's on Netflix streaming right now, by the way.
Yeah.
I have the DVDs, but it is on Netflix streaming. I got that giant Cylon head edition that came out about 10 years ago.
Oh yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. But the transfer quality, by the way, is terrible on it. The premiere episode doesn't look too bad, but the later episodes, I mean, they just look like they were transferred directly from my TV set in 1978.
Right.
There's picture noise, and the colors varied, and it looks like they found it in somebody's garage, you know, and salvaged it that way. But yeah, I thought that they had just kept going, because the original, the pilot, even though it was 3 hours long, they tried to cram a lot, you know, into that. They had already had the sneak attack, destroyed the colonies, and put the fleet together, the ragtag fleet, 40 minutes into the show.
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy. So because it jumps around so much, it's almost like a summary. It's almost like you're watching a 3 hour summary of a previous season before the new show starts. And because of that, when it came back from the Camp David stuff, I had totally forgotten what was going on and just assumed I'd missed a bunch.
Yeah, and it's really interesting if you look at that first story that they told. You're right, because they cram so much into the first half of it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the back half of it is more like a normal episode.
I mean,
it's almost like they had the pilot, which would have been the first 2 hours of them, you know, having the conflict with the Cylons and escaping in the ragtag fleet, and then, you know, deciding that they're going to go off to Earth. And then they've got this, you know, kind of extraneous third hour that's tacked on to that pilot episode, which is them on the planet and dealing with the Ovians and all that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I always thought it was kind of weird that they had that extra, you know, tag end of the story for that first episode. And I think part of it is, they did want to make it such a big event that they wanted that third hour for the premiere.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then interestingly, after the, you know, hours 4 and 5 ended up being a two-parter. So really you get, you know, the way it's put together, the first 5 quote unquote episodes, if you go by hours, the first 5 hours are really just 2 episodes, 2 stories.
Yeah. That was one of the things, even as a kid, I thought it was kind of cool that Galactica really didn't have a problem doing a lot of 2-part episodes, especially, you know, considering, you know, the first season, as much as they packed into it, there's a lot going on. And I know we're going to talk about it, you know, later on, but, you know, that first chunk of episodes really tells a lot of story.
Yeah.
And it seems kind of odd now in this day and age of kind of like decompressed storytelling that they crammed so much information and so much character development into, you know, the first 4 or 5 hours of the show, essentially.
Yeah. I think that there's no question that the writing on Galactica was in some ways a strength because it was very imaginative and everything. But in some ways, it was really the weakest part of the show. I mean, it's always been said that the thing that killed the show really was the scripts, because they had the effects, they had the cast, you know, they had the money. ABC was paying $1 million an hour for that show when no yeah. show cost anything like it. In fact, the 3-hour premiere cost $7 million.
Yeah, and it was the most expensive pilot episode ever shot up to that time. So
yeah, and the series,
you know, they were obviously putting money into it.
Oh, they're poor. Yeah, that's ultimately what killed it. If it had been any other show, it would have stayed on the air after the first season. You know, the premiere episode. I'm thinking back in my memory. I haven't looked this up, but I think I remember that the opening episode pulled in was number 5 for the week.
Oh yeah,
and if you know anything else, ABC would have been doing cartwheels. But for something that cost $7 million, they didn't just expect; they demanded that it be number one with a bullet or with a laser blast, right? And so when it wasn't number one, they were immediately like, "We're not paying $1 million an hour for something that's just going to be kind of, you know, hee-haw could get those kind of ratings," is basically what they were saying. So, you know, and
the funny thing about the ratings is, you know, because I was looking at it preparing to do the show, and it really kind of forced the other networks to counter program.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, you know, CBS moved some of their strongest shows up against it. You know, NBC was counter programming. So they all knew that ABC was kind of like bringing out the big guns with this. And it's almost like they had this thought that if they kind of could hang with it and outlast it, that ABC was not going to keep spending that much money on the show.
Yeah.
Like some of the other networks were probably just thinking, well, we'll just wage a war of attrition with them, mm-hmm. and eventually the show's going to go away.
It wasn't the Battlestar Galactic. It was the Bismarck. You just send out a lot of 30-minute little ship to chip away at it until it sinks. It's like they sabotaged it and tried to kill it. It's kind of unfortunate. But yeah, and so it kind of had a lack of script. So every third episode, in fact, 2 back-to-back episodes, you know, where Apollo and or Starbuck gets crash lands on a planet and has to be rescued, but they have an adventure while they're there. You know, that's like every other episode. And it's also neat because they borrowed some episodes from Alistair MacLean movies and novels, like the Ice Planet Zero is very much like the guns. The Guns of Navarone meets Ice Station Zebra.
Well, and they do that a couple of times, and I think that kind of harkens back to Glenn Larson's past TV history, that's kind of the way things were in the 70s. If you think about it, like a lot of shows would do an episode that was a riff on the Magnificent Seven or a riff on the Men on a Mission movie, like the Dirty Dozen, or, you know, they would do a Sherlock Holmes, you know, closed door mystery sort of a show. And, you know, it was kind of like, they thought the audience wouldn't get it unless it was comparable to something that they had seen before. Like, I'll never forget, there's one episode that's early in the run, the one where Apollo crashes on the planet.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the Wild West frontier planet, and there's a maroon Cylon that's kind of like a gunslinger. And, I mean, it's literally the movie Shane.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt about it. Like, they could have taken the script for Shane, cut it down to an hour, and just changed the names, and that would have been that episode of Galactica.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we get into the episodes and everything, which I want to kind of walk through a little bit, which would be kind of fun, the show itself had interesting origins in terms of what Glenn Larson was interested in. And I guess Donald Belisarius, there's a lot of, I mean, you know, originally it was supposed to be called Adam's Ark.
Right.
And it was Adama, I guess, was Adam. And it was pretty much saying, you know, that they would come to Earth and start over, and he's Adam. And so that fits into the whole life here began out there thing, which was stretched a little thinner when they got to their later version, which is Earth was just the 13th colony. You know, originally it was that Earth was seeded, they were trying to balance several different influences. Let me hit several influences, and you tell me what you think when I list these out. There's the Adam and Eve thing. There's Noah's Ark. There's the Mormons and the Great Trek to Utah, right? And he's basically Adam is Joseph Smith. I mean, well, Brigham Young. Right. And then Joseph Smith was dead. And then also there's this whole, it was the 1970s and Eric Von Daniken. You remember this?
Yeah, I was going to say that was the big one for me. Like, I remember when that was playing out too.
Yeah, that was because Jack Kirby was into that too with the Eternals and everything. For those that don't know, Eric Von Daniken was this guy that was writing books in the 70s and they were doing TV specials, kind of in search of type, you know, documentary drama, docudrama TV specials, where he was claiming that aliens had come to Earth to build the pyramids and all that kind of stuff. And ancient astronauts, you know, he'd find carvings that the Aztecs had done that looked like a rocket ship and say, see, the Aztecs had alien friends. And I thought it was interesting that they incorporated that into Battlestar Galactica. If you'll notice on Caprica, the skyscrapers are pyramids.
Yeah.
And the most clear example on Galactica is the helmets that the fighter pilots wear are Egyptian. If you ever watched Battlestar Galactica later and didn't know this whole 1970s Von Daniken connection, you might wonder why do the Viper pilot helmets look like King Tut, you know? And it's because they're trying to tie in this. That was what was really hip in the mid-70s was tying in this whole, you know, life here began out there, aliens came here, and
they cherry picked a lot of different things. It was kind of like, you know, we're going to take this from this and something else from another influence. And, you know, it always fascinated me as a kid because there was a lot of aesthetically, there was an Egyptian influence to a lot of it. I always thought it was cool that a lot of the names like Apollo and Athena, you know, it was Greek and Roman mythology that was kind of like clashing too. And so it was almost like they just said, well, we're just going to throw everything into a blender and say, OK, well, everything came from out there.
Yeah. 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 And then sort of split when it got to Earth. Yeah, and it's that idea of the 13th, you know, the lost colony that there's. You even have the horoscope incorporated into it with the with the 12 colonies being Caprica and Virgon and whatever, and then Earth being the lost 13th colony, which is like, you know, the Native Americans being the lost tribes of Israel in Mormon theology. Right. So there's just so many, like you say, they just cherry picked all these different things. And what's interesting to me is they had the blender all full and ready to go. And then what happened in May of 1977?
Oh, well, you know, Star Wars changed everything. Yeah. And that's why it's so fascinating to me that, you know, they were working on this and then rushed it into production to take advantage of Star Wars.
And brought in John Dykstra to do all the, and basically, see, I've always wondered what it never would have made it to the screen without Star Wars. I think it would have been in development forever, and it would have been an idea that never would have caught on because it's just too expensive, too weird, too out there. But if it had, without Star Wars, what would Battlestar Galactica have been like? Would it have been more mystical and less fighters flying around blowing each other up, or what?
See, I think it would have been more along the lines of a Star Trek kind of a show. And that's the other reason why I agree with you. I don't think it would have made the air if not for Star Wars, because it kind of hewed a little bit too much towards Star Trek. It wasn't about exploration.
Right.
It was about going out and finding the 13th colony, but it still kind of felt like that's the show it would have been. I mean, it's set wise, costume wise, effects wise, you know, if not for the breakthrough with Star Wars, I don't think Galactica would have been as good as it was.
You know, it actually has something in common with like four other properties that preceded it. It's Lost in Space, kind of, right? They're kind of lost in space.
Yeah.
It's Space 1999 in that, except that they're going to Earth instead of going away from Earth, but they're kind of, you know, encountering new weird things as they travel on their one big thing, like Space 1999. And then, of course, Star Trek, because they actually can steer, unlike the moon. And then Star Wars. So it has a whole lot of different elements to it that that were mashed together in a plus all the stuff we were just talking about, the mystical stuff, the Mormon stuff, the Von Daniken stuff. I mean, there was a lot going on just in the background of this show. It's fascinating.
Well, and that's the thing that I thought was kind of cool from the beginning was, you know, everybody talks about the similarities to Star Wars. And, you know, I think you and I probably remember there was a huge lawsuit when the show started.
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, 20th Century Fox and George Lucas were suing the pants off of Universal for ripping their idea off. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember. Do you remember exactly? It was like they had 34 or 35 specific things that they pointed to and said, this is where they got this stuff for Galactica from Star Wars.
Well, wasn't it originally called Star Worlds?
Yeah, I think you might be right.
I think it was Star Worlds, and they made them change that because it wasn't. I think Battlestar Galactica is a seven syllable mouthful.
Yeah.
And I think they originally were, because they ended up calling the first 3-hour episode Saga of a Star World, which doesn't really make a lot of sense unless you know that the show was originally called Star Worlds. But
yeah,
that is kind of, but you know, what's funny too is Star Worlds doesn't make any sense at all because every world is a star world basically.
right.
And it only makes sense in the context of Battlestar Galactica never ever bothering to get any of the astronomy right. I mean, I remember there's one episode, I forget which one it was, maybe early on, when they're all on the bridge and they come out of something into a new area. And I can't remember exactly how they put it, but Apollo says something to the effect of, we're leaving our galaxy, entering a whole new star system. And I'm like,
right.
Wow, that's like saying we're leaving North America, entering a whole new neighborhood, a whole new county. I mean, what? they never really bothered to worry about the science on the show very much.
And that's one of those things that I think looking back on it, it doesn't hold up quite as well as I remember as a kid. But, you know, I kind of forgave it, I guess, a little bit.
We were so glad to have it back then, though,
yeah,
weren't we? I mean,
that was the best we had. The thing I was going to point out was the religious aspect of it, like, really kind of, like, came out to me, I mean, even as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, even though Star Wars has a religion built into that world that Lucas created, you know, didn't seem like it was as integral a part to the story as Galactica's religious overtones. I mean, even though in Star Wars, you know, the Jedi had to use the Force and, you know, there was this quasi-religious aspect to the Force, there wasn't really full-blown religion.
Right.
That people believed in. And I always felt like with Galactica, that was something that was really cool because they had a religion that they believed in, and that was kind of guiding them. And it kind of gets back to what you were saying about the Mormon kind of slant to some of the storytelling was that's what was leading them. It wasn't like they had a map and they knew where Earth was, and it's just like, oh, well, we're here and we have to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they had no clue. They just had all of these various, you know, mythology and, you know, religious teachings that they had all grown up with and kind of believed in, and they were kind of putting their faith in that.
Yeah, it really was about faith.
Faith was such a big part of a lot of the key mythological underpinnings of the show.
Yeah, and we're going to get into some of those as we go through the episodes. That's really good. You know, I was going to say, I want to kind of break down maybe some of the episodes and what's going on. I kind of divide the series, and I always have in my mind, into sort of three parts.
Yeah, me too. That's weird that you say that.
Well, I'm gonna tell you my three and see if it matches up.
Okay.
The first part I think of, or like those early, well, it's like the big three part, the 3-hour opener, the COBOL two parter, and then there were a bunch of one shots and the Ice Planet Zero one, and then that's sort of the first part. The second part was when the Pegasus showed up, and in the second part you got, you know, the Living Legend. And you got, right after that, just about, you got the Count Ibley thing, and the cosmic stuff gets introduced. And then the third part is when you brought in the Eastern Alliance and have that whole other new enemy show up.
Yeah.
Does that kind of clock with how you see it, or what?
Oh, exactly. And the weird thing about that is, if you think about it from the standpoint of how TV production works, you know, you go into making a TV show and you're hoping it's going to be on the air for you know, years and years and years. And it seems to me like they were kind of throwing all of their creative eggs into the first season. Like, I have no idea what they would have done for a season two.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like you said, it was kind of like there are three different sections to that first season, and they didn't really let any of them kind of develop and ferment into something that could have carried them, you know, three or four seasons down the road.
Yeah, it was like a collection of very interesting two-parters. Almost all the two-parters are good.
Oh, yeah, they are.
And then a bunch of a collection of just very episodic one-offs.
Well, because I remember, you know, as it played out in that first season, you know, the first chunk of episodes in any new show are kind of introductory episodes. You know, you have to kind of reinvent the wheel every week and reintroduce the characters and reintroduce the situation and you know, kind of have these standalone episodes before you get into, you know, what the show's actually about. And those first 6-7 hours of the show are kind of like that. And then when they introduce Count Ebley, and we'll talk about this more in depth, I kind of felt like, okay, now it's going to hit the ground running with the actual story.
Hmm.
Like, there's more stuff going on here than them just trying to find Earth.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's going to be, you know, a continuing plot thread here. And it happened for a couple of episodes, and then they dropped it and, you know, closed the season out with the Eastern Alliance stuff. And I thought, oh, okay, now this is what they're going to do. There's another group out there. There's other people out in the galaxy, so now we're going to have a little bit more conflict with these people. And then, you know, it just kind of ended, and obviously the show got canceled, and then they decided to retool it for Galactica 1980, but it still didn't feel like they were going to continue that Eastern Alliance thread into a second season.
Do you remember, did the Star Wars Thanksgiving special come out in 78? It wasn't Thanksgiving of 77, was it?
No, it was 78. Yeah.
So think about this. Star Wars in the fall of in November of 78 was putting out the infamous Thanksgiving special. Galactica was in the process of showing The Living Legend parts 1 and 2 at the same time.
Yeah.
I think Galactica won late 1978.
Oh yeah, yeah. Cuz if you ask anybody other than the pilot, I think the Living Legend two-parter is probably, bar none, the favorite episode of everybody that loves Galactica.
Yeah. Oh, the Pegasus. Yeah. Well, having another Battlestar. I mean, and I got to say, again, I'm not going to talk too much about the new series, but I will say this as it relates to the old one. When they finally got around to doing Pegasus on the new series, the 2003, 2004, roughly, era one, I was very excited, but I figured it was inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
But when it, spoiler, if you haven't watched the new Battlestar Galactica, and it's been 10 years, it didn't go away after it appeared. You know, I mean, it was so predictable in retrospect that they got rid of the Pegasus at the end of the Living Legend Part 2. It's just so predictable because they had to reset. They had to hit the reset button.
Yeah.
And on the new series, they kept it around. I'm like, holy crap, they're keeping the Pegasus around. We got two Battlestars. I was so excited because I always wished that they had had the guts on any sci-fi show back in the 70s and 80s, right? They always hit the reset on shows back then. It really wasn't until Babylon 5 that you quit hitting the reset button. That's one of the reasons Babylon 5 was so mind-blowing. And I just used to think if only they had had the courage to keep the Pegasus, even if, you know, kill all, if you can't afford to pay Lloyd Bridges, that's fine. But they kept Sheba around, right? They kept a couple of other Bojay.
Yep.
So, Lord, I pulled that out of my head from 35 years ago. But if you can do that, you can keep the model, right? It's the same model. They use the same ship, you know. So how cool would it have been?
As you know from Real Life Fan, all you have to do is take a sticker off of it and put another sticker on that says Pegasus on the model.
Yeah,
Come on.
I'm building the new – I got to mention that real quick since you brought it up, and I appreciate it. The Mobius Models has last year, I guess, was the 35th anniversary of the series that we're talking about. This year's the 35th anniversary of its cancellation. Dope. And so Mobius Models, I guess they go back and get the licenses of sort of defunct models, and they put out really nice new versions. I had the Battlestar Galactica model back in from Monogram Revell back in 78, 79, whatever. And I remember that it was fun. It was neat. It was modeled in dark gray. But it looked like they had just taken whatever little pieces of, you know, sprues that they had lying around and glued them onto a onto a sculpture of it. It had like wagon wheels and crap, you know, as detail. This new one is gorgeous, and I've been building it with my little girl, so I haven't decided yet. They give you a whole little set of different stickers of the name to put on the landing bays, and they've got the Galactica, the Pegasus, the Atlantia. I thought I remembered a Pacifica and Acropolis and a couple of others, so I'm still trying to decide which one I'm going to name this Battlestar when it's finished. It's almost done. Everybody on Facebook is like, oh, you got to name it Galactica. I'm like, I may not want to name it Galactica. Maybe, right. Maybe I want to name it Atlantia and then take a sledgehammer to it.
Atlantia Death Squad attack.
I just love that they had an Atlantia Death Squad. And apparently the Atlantia Death Squad consisted of one Cylon fighter that flew into the hangar bay and blew up.
Yeah, that was it.
That was it. Well, that takes us into, I want to look at that opening pilot episode a little bit more. Going back and watching the opening, watch the first 40 minutes of it. I mean, it's so fun because that's basically the whole fall of the colonies, the sneak attack. And as I was watching it for probably the sixth time in my life yesterday and this morning, I couldn't help but think they've been at war with the Cylons for 1,000 years. And so they know how treacherous and evil and horrible and demonic the Cylons are, right? And yet when the Cylons say, hey, we want to have a peace conference, but you need to bring every battleship you have, okay?
Right.
And fly way away from your home planets, and we'll meet you there.
That's one of the things.
Well, hold on. I'll let you get into it, but here's the thing. So the Cylons did that, and the humans fall for it. I'm thinking, if the humans are that stupid, how did they make it 1,000 years before losing to the Cylons? And B, if it took the Cylons 1,000 years to figure out that the colonies were that stupid, they should have won the war 800 years ago if the colonies were going to fall for something like that. I put that to you.
It took Baltar to do it.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. I mean, they needed somebody like Baltar to be able to convince the colonies to be that stupid.
He must have been like, you know, Christ or Muhammad, like beloved and trusted. Because if anybody off the street had just come up and said, the Cylons want to meet every Battlestar, you know, 8 million light years from here, they'd have been like, get out of our face. We're in a war with them for 1,000 years. So,
And I think that's one of the things that they were trying to cram so much into the pilot.
Yeah.
I wish they had spent a little bit more time setting up Baltar, because I know that he wasn't intended to be what he became throughout the show.
Right.
But he is kind of a reoccurring villain.
Well, he's the main villain of the show. They decided they needed a human villain.
I mean, besides the Cylons, he's the guy. Right. And he's the one that every time he comes back, you kind of want everybody to want his head. And they really don't do as much, like you said, to kind of set up, you know, who's this guy? How much power and influence does he have that he can convince the Quorum of 12 to just go along with this?
Yeah, he's a more interesting character than I think they realized when they were making the show. And you want to know more about him. I mean, again, the new show, I think, did that better. Whether you like or don't like, you who out there listening, whether you like or didn't like the British actor that played him in the new version, at least they made him interesting and explored his psychology a good bit, whereas the old one was just a cardboard stand-up villain. And in fact, in the original version of the pilot, you know, he was killed at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
And in the Marvel Super Special, they, you know, it's interesting. For Star Wars, Marvel did two big treasury editions, those oversized giant comics of the pilot of Star Wars. They did the 6 issues of the comic too to cover it, but they put it together in two big treasury editions. But for Battlestar Galactica, they did a slick magazine format.
Yep.
I used to have that, man. I loved that comic. It was, the art wasn't that great, but the art's never that great on adaptations of movies and TV. Back then it wasn't. But I clearly remember the panel where the Cylon pulls out his sword and kills Baltar. And I'm going, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Because the show was already on then. And if do you, did you ever have that, the super special?
I remember reading it. I don't think I ever owned it.
Okay. I think that later on, because I kept buying the Marvel Battlestar Galactica series. They did a comic book of it just you know, concurrently with Star Wars. I think that they explained that the Cylons had rebuilt him as a cyborg in the comics. It was how how they got around having already shown him being chopped up. Yeah, so... but yeah, John Kalikos though, awesome.
Oh God, he was Baltar. So good.
Yeah,
I remember when they did the theatrical release of the pilot.
Yeah,
the spring after the premiere, and I made my mom take me to go see it. And you know, it's the same. That's the Baltar's end in the theatrical release too. Is you know. Mm-hmm. The sword comes out and they hack his head off. And yeah. I remember, you know, sitting there thinking, wait, this isn't how it happened. Like, yeah. I've seen most of the show. He's still around. Like, I don't know why they did that.
Yeah.
You know, being a kid at the time, I didn't really understand why they did it. And I don't, as an adult, understand why they did it. He was a great character.
Yeah, I think that probably the networks may have gone to him and said, we need a villain that people can relate to rather than a bumpy headed imperious leader sitting up in the chair with Count Ibley's voice, which we'll get to. Anything else about the pilot? I want to kind of just, there's a whole bunch of episodes we're going to basically be able to skip, but I do want to hit five or six really important ones. So anything else about that pilot episode? I mean, like you said, you summed it up really well that it was like, They basically got the whole setup of the show in the first 40 minutes, and then after that, it was just almost like an extended regular episode of trying to get fuel and running into weird aliens and stuff.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff that, looking back on it, seems kind of, you know, 70s TV cheesy to me. You know, once you get that through the first two-thirds of it, and they've kind of gotten away from the Cylons and are just kind of trying to figure out what they're going to do, and they decide they're going to go towards Earth. Characters don't do things that you would assume people would do dealing with the tragedy they've just been through. And, you know, I love Starbuck to death, but some of the choices he makes during the pilot episode kind of bother me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're on a planet looking for fuel because the fleet's going to run out of fuel and the Cylons are getting close. And, you know, he's trying to talk to the six-eyed, you know, three-mouthed singers to set them up on a tour.
Yeah,
because he wants to make money. Or he spends a lot of time gambling. And I'm like, okay, I know this is Starbuck and all, but come on.
Yeah, you were kind of in like a post-9/11 situation or much worse, right? It's hard to imagine that. I think they were just kind of referring him back to those World War II characters that were always smoking cigars and planning some scheme while the other soldiers were fighting. You know, I mean, you see those in a lot of World War II movies. But the difference was the U.S. had Pearl Harbor, but we hadn't been destroyed.
They're
freaking refugees. You know, it's not a campaign, a crusade to liberate Europe. They're freaking refugees from the Holocaust.
I know you got episodes that you want to go through, so this will be the only time that I touch on the Reimagined series. I think this is where there was a difference because in 1978, we were far removed from World War II. We were far removed from Pearl Harbor. You know, we weren't that far removed from the Vietnam War, but that was fought overseas. Like, that didn't really hit us
at
home. The Reimagined show was just a couple of years after 9/11. So as a country, we had gone through that kind of a situation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the devastation of it was still affecting all of us. So it was a lot easier for us to deal with that through the prism of Galactica and understand what they were going through as characters.
Yeah, that's really
good
point.
You know, it was a little bit more bright and shiny in 78, even though these people had gone through, you know, a genocidal attack. It was still TV. It was still the 70s. So, you know, they weren't going to get too deep and dark with it.
Yeah, they needed Starbuck to be a wacky, fun character so people would tune in and want to watch. I guess you couldn't make the show a death march because nobody would have wanted to.
No, right.
Although, honestly, the new version kind of got that way at times.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It became something of a chore at times. Well, so after the opening 3 hour, when we got a two-parter where we basically say goodbye to Jane Seymour and have another person bite the dust, which was Lost Planet of the Gods Part 1 and 2, where they really quickly get to COBOL. And there was even a reference in the opening episode, the 3 hour, to COBOL being where they were going to go to have the peace conference, which is weird because it seems like it's such a big deal and it's so hard for them to get there in episode 2 and 3. But
yeah, I kind of thought that too.
But yeah, Lost Planet of the Gods, they more of the Egyptian stuff. This is supposed to be the ancient home world of humans or whatever. And we get more of Baltar, and they're down on the surface, and they're trying to, basically that's where they find the map or whatever that gives them a mystical sense that they know where they're going, is my understanding, right?
Yeah, and like Adama had been, you know, trying to interpret different things and was having visions, and yeah, and you know, all sorts of metaphysical stuff was going on to kind of point them in the direction.
And so Apollo kind of had gotten together with the TV reporter from the first one, Serena. Which was funny. They say introducing Jane Seymour, and she'd been in like James Bond. She'd been a Bond girl like 3 years earlier.
Yeah, right.
Who they were introducing her to at this point. But anyway, so I mean, not a whole lot to say about that. I thought the new series did that better too. But the Lost Planet of the Gods, it's kind of neat. It's a nice two-parter. You get some fun stuff going on.
Well, and it's cool because that's also the episode where, you know, the Colonial Warriors are getting sick for some reason, and so like all of the pilots are like out of action, and you know, Adama doesn't know what he's going to do, and they end up having to recruit people.
Yeah, and it's the women.
Know, so they and it's all the women. Yeah, it's
like that's cool. Yeah,
there aren't any other guys in the fleet that can fly ships. They have to get all these women.
Yeah, well, apparently the Pegasus didn't have any problem with female pilots. Of course, there was some nepotism, but.
Well, that's true.
Let's see. So then you got the two episodes that are basically almost the same episode, where you have a warrior, as they call their pilots, who is stranded on a planet and has to deal with issues there and then get back. And one, it's Apollo, and the other, it's Starbuck. That's the Lost Warrior and the Long Patrol. Yeah, Red Eye was the – you're talking about Shane.
Yeah.
To me,
Red Eye. Yeah.
Lord, the less said about these, the better. This is when it seemed like the show went from a $7 million budget to a $7 budget, but – I'd like to just skip on ahead if we can. Gun on Ice Planet Zero Parts 1 and 2, another cool two-parter. Now, it is kind of brain dead, but it's neat in that they try to do two different Alistair MacLean movies. And I'll put a plug in here. If you haven't listened to Mark Buskett and me talk about the Alistair MacLean movies, go back to like episode 19 of this show, and we had a really fun time going through Ice Station Zebra and Guns of Navarone, among others, which are the two that this is based on. They have a giant gun that the human has developed, I believe, that the Cylons have taken over.
Yeah.
And for some reason, space is no longer three-dimensional, so the fleet has to go right next to this planet.
Right, exactly.
And they so like the Guns of Navarone. And then they have to go down, and oh, it's frozen like Ice Station Zebra, so everybody's in parkas and stuff. And they have to go and blow it up before the Galactica and the fleet get blown up by the big gun. What did you think about this one?
Well, let me tell you, because as much as I love the Living Legend two-parter with the Pegasus, this two-parter is my favorite 2 hours of Galactica of the original series. Like, I love these episodes. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's the mix of the characters. Like, I love when they bring in the prisoners from the penal ship.
Oh, the Dirty Dozen, okay.
Yeah, and there's a good mix of some you know, really cool character actors from that era that guest star. And I just love, like, that whole thing. And, you know, what's funny is I watched it as a kid, you know, and I was totally into Galactic at this point. We're like – you know, 2 months into the run of the show when these episodes come on, and I loved it. And I loved the two-parter. And then, you know, let's fast forward like 10 years maybe, and I see Guns of Navarone for the first time. And the whole time I'm watching the Guns of Navarone, I'm like, this is the Galactica episode.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, they did this on Galactica. And, it, you know, it wasn't like there was no part of me that said Galactica ripped off Guns of Navarre.
That's awesome.
It was the exact opposite. And I'm, you know, an adult at this point. I'm like, man, I can't believe they ripped off Galactica, even though I know Guns of Navarone in my adult brain was made, you know, 15, 20 years before the Galactic episode. It was just funny to me.
That's great. That's great.
Because, you know, like you said, I mean, the setup is exactly the same. And, you know, they have to go on this, you know, mission to knock out the, you know, this laser gun that's going to take out the whole fleet.
Right. Oh, yeah. And well, and when I was a kid and saw this, after the two kind of one-off, very disappointing episodes, I was very disappointed by the two lost pilot episodes. I just thought, oh, this show has gone from massive fleet actions to a guy in the Wild West. Wow, this sure has gone crappy. But Gun and Ice Planet Zero restored my faith that they could do big, bold, you know, exciting adventure episodes, and they were going to put some money into it. I think they put all their budget into about 20% of the episodes, and the other 80% of the episodes just had stock footage and cheap scripts. But so we got another couple of one-offs, the Magnificent Warriors, the Young Lords. It all blurs together in my mind. I have no idea. Then you got the next, and probably, like you say, the most popular, the Living Legend Part 1 and Part 2, where the Pegasus had somehow not been destroyed, and Commander Kane, and how great is it that Adama is Adama, and the guy kind of under him that's violent is Kane, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, and what a great Lloyd name. Bridges is so good in this episode.
Those gall-monging Cylons. Yeah, he's basically Patton or MacArthur.
Yeah.
I love how they just brought in all these World War II movies and characters and everything into Galactica and kind of recycled them and made them cool. Yeah, he wears a warrior's uniform, a pilot's uniform, rather than a commander's uniform. He's hands on. He's out there in the fighters. He's not going to be standing on the bridge in the blue, you know, with all the jewelry stuff on it. They had a bedazzler or something that they made. You know, he's actually flying the fight. He's got a riding crop, you know, whatever.
Oh yeah, the riding crop was great.
I thought he, you know, have ivory handled blasters or something. You know, I mean, he's totally Patton. And it's great. And
he shows up and, you know, his first, I mean, everybody's surprised that they're still alive for one thing. And everybody's happy that there's another Battlestar around. But then he's the one that's kind of like, hey, we've been fighting Cylons this whole time.
Yeah.
Like, what have you guys been doing? And, you know, Adama has to be the one kind of sitting there saying, well, we're going to go to Earth. And he's like, no, that's ridiculous. Let's go kick some Cylon butt.
Oh, gall-monging Cylon. I got to have to find an audio clip of him saying that.
Yeah, exactly.
Drop it in. This is what I thought that to quickly touch on the new series, I thought the new series did a great job with this too. They even amped it up another multiple degrees. You know, they had Admiral Kane be just like bug nuts crazy, but understandably. And the whole thing about how they got away, they just hyperspace jumped without even looking, right, to get away.
Yeah, it was a blind jump. Yeah.
Right, it was beautiful. The Razor one shot. If you haven't seen, I'm sure you have, Jim, but for those that haven't seen Razor, the one off movie they did later on video of the new Battlestar Galactica, the second half of it is okay, but the opening part where they give kind of the Pegasus' story from when the first attack happened. Man, what a great space opera that whole first hour or so is. It's just fantastic.
Well, and that's where, like, the newer version flipped the script a little bit, because they had Kane as Adama's superior officer within the fleet before the Cylon attack.
Yeah.
You know, she was already an admiral.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the original show, Kane and Adama were equals.
Yeah. And Adama kind of had like seniority, it seemed like.
Right. Well, because he had the rest of the fleet.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a little bit more of a tug of war, because in the revamp show, having the added political dimension to it, where, you know, you've got Laura Roslin there as president kind of mediating between Kane and Adama. In the original series, you didn't have that presence. What you had was the Quorum of 12, mm-hmm. who we're all, you know, kind of hero worshiping Kane.
Yeah.
So, you know, even though Adama was, you know, de facto leader of the fleet under the Quorum of 12, the Quorum was pretty much going with whatever Kane said, because he had actually had victories over the Cylons.
Yeah. Yeah, and they kind of had to make Adama somewhat senior somehow over Kane in the original show, because it was supposed to be an action adventure show, and they didn't want to be too much of it to be the politics, you know, the
right.
Like in the new version, they had to contrive ways that Adama would be able to subvert a superior officer. In the old one, you didn't have to do that. Adama just basically relieves him. So it was easier. And the drama comes from the action rather than from relieving him. You know, the drama comes from everybody reacting to it, I guess.
Well, and I love how they ended it too, because the second part, they have to, you know, do kind of like the daring, you know, suicide mission against the Cylons to try and get fuel for the rest of the fleet.
Right.
And of course, you know, Lloyd Bridges sacrifices the Pegasus so that the Galactica can get away with the fuel.
I still haven't given up hope that the Pegasus might come back.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. Like, they didn't want to destroy the Pegasus. They wanted to leave the door open for the Pegasus to come back at some point.
Yeah, you don't see it blow up. It goes in among the three big base stars, and Baltar is frantically retreating. That's one of the best moments in the show, is when Baltar is in a fighter attacking the Galactica.
Yeah.
And the Cylon's like, Sir, what is it? I'm trying to watch the final destruction, you know, of the Galactica. Sir, I really think you should take a look at the other battle star.
Right, right.
And Baltar's like, oh, get us.
But yeah, and here. The look on Baltar's face when the Cylon says that is priceless.
The Pegasus is just like coming right at him. That is awesome. That's why it was so cool to have two on there, two battle stars. I loved it. And the Pegasus is to the fleet, you know, as Kane was to Adama, you know, I mean, they're kind of representative of their two ships, the brash one versus the one that's protective, you know. So,
yeah,
I always wanted it to come back, and maybe it would have in a second season. That would have been awesome. Now, there's Fire in Space, which it's the Muffet episode.
Yeah, Fire in Space is the episode you have to do after the big budget episode with two battle stars fighting it out with the Cylons.
Yeah.
You have to have like the small bottle show where not a lot's going on outside of the ship.
Yeah.
You have to save budget somewhere.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I think of Babylon 5, they'd have an episode where there was like all this CGI, and then the next episode it'd be like people sitting around talking for an hour, you know.
Right, right.
just to make up the time. So next comes the big cosmic two-parter. It's amazing how close those two-parters were together. War of the Gods Part 1 and 2, where the light ship, which looks like a cross maybe, or a plus sign, or it's like a floating city of light, and it's basically supposed to be like the angelic, heavenly people. Their uniforms all turn white when they're on it. It was kind of neat. And then these weird, like, demon things come flying around the... No, those were the angels, and they were scared of them, but they were actually looking for Count Ibley, weren't they?
Yeah, they were looking... You don't know what's going on at first. And that, I actually thought they did a really good job in the first part of the two-parter of being very mysterious about what's going on.
Yeah.
Like, they were just kind of, like, slowly giving you information and, you know, drawing the mystery out as much as they could until the end of the first hour, when they find this, you know, glowing red planet in the middle of nowhere with, you know, Count Ibley on it, who's supposedly the sole survivor of, you know, some catastrophic thing that happened on the planet, and they pick him up and bring him back to the Galactica.
And he's basically the devil, but he's also, like, they shoot him and he looks like the devil or something.
Yeah.
But he's got the voice of the Imperious leader. And from what I understand, I've ordered it, but it hadn't come yet. Those Richard Hatch and Christopher Golden books that kind of continue the original story, supposedly in them, the Count Ibley is the guy who actually creates the Cylons originally.
Well, it's funny because, you know, there were several different continuations of that original concept before the Sci-Fi Channel revamped it. And there were comics that were done that kind of picked up the story. And then Richard Hatch's books. And I think they both have different interpretations of why the Imperious leader has Count Ebley's voice. And it depends on which one you want to, you know, lend more credence to. But right. I tend to think, you know, Richard Hatch was there, so he would know, right?
Yeah. Well, I always just figured it was because Patrick McNee has a cool voice and they brought him back to play the part.
He does have a cool voice.
But when you try to incorporate it into the story, then you can get creative and say, well, it's because Count Ebley was basically Space Devil. And he, you know, he's Space Lucifer. Well, no, there's a Lucifer. He's the robot. Space Satan, basically. And, and he had something to do with the Cylons and the Imperious leader. But in any case, at the end of that episode, they go back down to the planet. But what do they find? I don't even remember. I don't think they showed us. They kept saying, don't go in there. Don't look or something, right?
Yeah, and I think I always chalked it up to one of those things that they were probably going to explore later on. There was something there, and I figured that wasn't the last time we were going to see Count Ebley either.
Yeah.
Like, I thought he was going to come back.
It seems like Apollo and maybe Sheba were there, and Sheba wanted to go look and see what was in there, and Apollo, like, grabbed her and says, no, don't go look. You know, it's terrible or something. And was it dead bodies, or was it?
See, I always thought it was. Like, I thought there was some – it was some – something had to do with Ebley and the people that lived on that planet.
Yeah.
And there was going to be a mystery that was going to be revealed at some point.
I thought it was something that incriminated Ebley and showed that he wasn't the savior, that he was acting like he was, you know, was supposed to be. So, well, in any case, they kind of left that mystery hanging. But we do see the light ship again later, interestingly. So then we had the one where I believe it was, Fred Astaire?
Yeah, Fred Astaire.
Played Starbuck's maybe father, maybe not. And another couple of one-offs, Murder on the Rising Star. And then we get the move into the third phase of the show with Greetings from Earth, which is an interesting title considering that they were later discovered it wasn't Earth. It was called Terra, right? Experiment. But it wasn't Earth Terra. It was some other Terra, right?
Yeah, and I always thought they didn't do a good enough job in these couple of episodes towards the end of the season of explaining where they were going, as far, story-wise, not the fleet.
Right.
But you know, they set up, well, these people may be from Earth, and then oh no wait, they're not from Earth, they're from a different planet. And then they introduce the Eastern Alliance, who we don't have a whole lot of information about. Just know that they're kind of like our version of the Empire almost.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's this planet planet Terra's out there, and, you know, but it's not Earth. Mm. So I always felt like there was more there too. Like, they didn't fully explain it because they were trying to leave some threads for season two where maybe there were more than just 13 colonies.
Yeah.
And maybe this was a part of the galaxy that we just didn't know about, and they had kind of developed parallel to the 12 colonies.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't really clear. My theory was that basically they just wanted to have villains that maybe were a little more identifiable with than the Cylons. The Cylons were getting a little stale, you know, at this point, and they wanted to have actually humans. I mean, Lloyd Bachner, I believe, the guy that was later on Dynasty or whatever, was the head of the Eastern Alliance, and he's a good, you know, smirking Nazi-style officer-type villain, so he was a lot of fun. You know, I still remember that, like, they have him arrested on a shuttle or something. He's like, we have the largest spaceships in the universe, and they look out the window and see the Galactic, and he's like, holy crap!
Yeah, well, I remember, like, wasn't there something where his ship was actually taken into the Galactica, like it was in the landing bay?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They thought they had the badass fleet.
He's got the biggest ship in the Eastern Alliance, and they just fly it into the Galactica's landing base.
Exactly. He just, like, wets his pants. Exactly. So that whole little bit there with Greetings from Earth and Baltar's escape, we failed to note that during the Count Ebley episodes, Baltar panics because of these lights flying around. and basically goes to meet with the this is great. He wants to do a parley, right, to meet with Adama. And they're like, oh, sure, come on over. And then he gets there, and they just arrest him. And he's like, but you promised. They're like, you're Baltar. We promise you anything. Screw it. We're not going to stick to the rules with you. You got to be kidding. You're freaking Hitler. We're not going to, oh, we got to obey the truce. No, you're under arrest. Get in the prison barge. So then Baltar tries to escape. That was kind of neat. Then you got this odd sort of one-off, take the Celestra, I don't even barely remember it. And then finally, the Hand of God. Now, the one big thing that they promoted the heck out of leading up to the Hand of God was this is the episode where the Galactica is tired of running, right?
Yeah.
A lot of the criticism was, well, people didn't like the show because they always are just running. We want to see them stand and fight and go after and be on the attack, you know. That's one of the reasons the Pegasus and Kane were so popular. They actually wanted to go attack. And so Adama says, I'm tired of running. And they do like a commando attack. Do you remember the other two things that were noteworthy kind of about this episode? Beside it being the last one, obviously.
Yeah, well, I remember I don't remember the circumstances because it's been forever since I've seen this episode, but somehow they got a Cylon Raider. Like, that
Baltars.
Was part of the plan.
They had Baltars, yeah.
They had Baltar Cylon Raider, that's right. And then I remember the very end of the episode.
Yeah.
Which I'm not going to give away just yet because we need to talk about it. But what were the things you were thinking about?
Well, that's one, the very last little bit. And I think that was just a last ditch cry for help. Don't cancel us. We're going there.
Yeah.
And the other thing was you had the gold-plated Cylon with all the bling, man.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The blinged-out Cylon Commander. That was cool. When I was a kid, you know, when you're a kid, that kind of stuff is awesome. You're like, oh, I want that action figure. I think I eventually did get a gold Cylon. I think they made him.
Yeah, because I remember that was like one of those things where you had to like mail in your proof of
birth. Oh, yeah. Oh, I did whatever you had to do. I jumped through whatever hoops they put in front of me. Absolutely.
Right.
I got my dang gold Cylon. Absolutely.
Right, but I remember, you know, getting through that whole episode. And in and of itself, it was a fairly standard, you know, self-contained episode of them, you know, attacking the Cylons for once. But I remember the very end of the episode because they had been getting these, you know, mysterious transmissions from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought it was from Earth. And then the last scene is Apollo and Starbuck, you know, in their, you know, observatory or wherever it is on the Galactica. And they decide to walk out of the room and go back about their business. And after they walk out, there's a transmission of the Apollo 11 moon landing.
Yeah, that was
that the Galactica receives. And it's like, oh, okay, now we know kind of a time period that we're in, maybe.
We
at least know that they're on the right track.
Right, exactly. That was what it was. You knew they're on the right track. They're getting closer. And that was cool because it had no real indication up to that point. But the other thing, I was very disappointed by that because in my little 10-year-old, 11-year-old brain, I was holding out hope that when Galactica got to Earth, and of course, in retrospect, this was ridiculous, but I was holding out hope that when Galactica got to Earth, it would be the Earth of like Star Trek era, and we'd have badass spaceships of our own and could help them defeat the Cylons. So when you know what comes along a year and a half later and it's 1980, I'm just like, we're going to get killed. We're not even as advanced as one of the colonies.
Yeah.
This
well,
is horrible.
That is even in my, you know, 8-9-year-old brain. That was the biggest disappointment for me with Galactica 1980. Because, you know, we go through the whole first season and, you know, say what you will about it. I mean, it's very uneven and, you know, there's things that don't hold up over the years, but it's a very solid first season of a science fiction show that's that ambitious.
Yeah.
You know, I would say its worst episodes are no worse than the worst episodes of Babylon 5's first season.
No, that's true. That's absolutely.
And
that's fair.
The best episodes of that season are on par with, you know, Babylon 5 or Next Generation. I mean, Next Generation on Star Trek the first season is not that great.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was promising. And had they been allowed to kind of expand in the second season and continue the story, I was interested to see where it was going to go. But then we get 1980 where they say, well, we're not going to spend any money on it.
Yeah.
Everything has to be on Earth so that we can cut down on costs. We're not going to have all these tremendous effects and sets and things like that. And, you know, they introduce some really stupid concepts to the idea. But I was really more disappointed that they showed up and Earth was present day Earth.
Yeah.
Because even in my kid brain, I'm thinking to myself, well, the 13th colony would have been founded, you know, not long after the original 12. I mean, how long did it take them mm-hmm. with their technology to go from the 12 colonies to Earth? And shouldn't we be way more advanced than we are now?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, these people had the technology to get from the 12 colonies to Earth. We wouldn't have started off, you know, just as cavemen, or we wouldn't have started off with, you know, Bronze Age technology. Like, we would have had computers and lasers and spaceships back, you know, 50,000 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So we should be way more advanced than we are now. And, you know, like you said, I mean, it should have been a situation where the Galactica showed up and everybody on Earth was like, oh, there's Cylons behind you? Okay, we're fine.
Just roll out, you know, a few Enterprises and, you know, whatever, and blow them away. I mean, that would have been so cool if like, they had done a final episode instead of doing Galactica Discovers Earth, which was that one-off before they went into the Galactica 1980. If Galactica Discovers Earth had been just, they could have just said, oh, screw it. You know, we're not bringing the show back. Let's just have fun. The Galactica shows right. up and it's like the freaking Starfleet and they just roll over the Cylons and just trash them. That would have been hilarious and entertaining, but you know, they didn't. So the series as a whole, I want to make sure people understand. I mean, We've this is what we do, right? We find fault, we're digging through the bones of it and everything. But honestly, I think it should be pretty obvious to all the listeners how much we both love the property, right? Love that show for all of its faults and flaws of being a 1970s, you know, network TV show.
Yeah, and to the point where even when they did the reboot, there were things that they took from the original show that just made me giddy when I saw it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, in the very first hour of the reboot miniseries, when they go on the Galactica, which they've turned into this museum,
yeah.
You know, when it's decommissioned, when they're having the ceremony, what's the anthem of the 12 colonies?
Yes.
It's the original series theme. And I'm like, oh, my God, that's so cool.
Because the original series theme is one of the best TV theme music pieces in television history, and
yeah.
They had to use it somewhere. I mean, I understand that they wanted the new series to have the drum solo thing or whatever, and that's fine. It suited the mood, but yeah, you had to fit that in somewhere because, you know, the 70s were the era of the big, you know, London Symphony Orchestra triumphant, you know, march. I'm sure I'm going to be playing it all through our whole episode here and have little clips I'll drop in. So you've been hearing it at this point already if everything goes well in post-production. So, well,
you know, or seeing the original series Vipers in the museum.
Yeah. Yeah. And they flew them.
And knowing that those were like older versions,
mm-hmm.
You know, that was, you know, Adama's Viper.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when he was younger and you know, little things like that.
Oh, later you even see the old school Cylons.
Yeah.
Those were fantastic. I loved when he fought with the Cylon all the way down, like parachuting or something. That was great.
So, yeah, I mean, there were lots of little nods to the original show, and that's how much I love the original show. And I always look at it as, in some ways, it was not monetarily and not overall success-wise, but in some ways, one season of Battlestar Galactica was almost as successful as three seasons of the original Star Trek.
Yeah.
When you look at how much it influenced what came after it and, you know, how successful the reboot was.
Yeah.
So, oh, absolutely. I mean, there was a lot of groundwork that they laid, and I still think that there's stuff that could be done with that property.
Well, and supposedly we're going to get a Bryan Singer movie at some point, but I'll believe it when I see it.
Right.
Yeah.
He's a little busy. He's got an expert.
He is. So, kind of last thoughts then. Overview of the 78-79 series. How do you feel about it today?
I look at it in some ways like I look at a lot of stuff from my childhood, where there's a lot of it that still holds up, and I love watching it every once in a while. There's stuff, you know, as we were going through the episodes, you know, there's episodes that you can clearly skip over because they're just filler. But then it's still kind of cool to sit down and, you know, watch the living legend for no other reason than I want to watch the Pegasus again.
Yeah.
Or, you know, see some of the good Baltar episodes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the cast was great. I think that's one of the things that they lucked out on, was they had a really good cast for that show.
Although Athena was criminally underused. I mean, I think if you took every scene she's in that series and you edited them all together, it'd last about 8 minutes.
Yeah, and I kind of wish at some point that they had put her in a Viper.
Yeah.
Like they needed to do something to get her out of the control room.
Cassiopeia had way more screen time than Athena did.
Yeah,
especially later.
Yeah, because she never left the control room. No. Like, there was never a reason for her to go out and join in the adventure.
I mean, they messed around with her and Starbuck and the love triangle for a while, but ultimately Starbuck pretty much ends up with Cassiopeia, and Athena is just kind of forgotten character. I think that Rigel, the lady on that launches the Vipers, gets more screen time than Athena.
Right.
And she's not even credited, hardly. Maybe in the end credits, but she's certainly not at the beginning. So... All right. Well, yeah, to kind of wrap things up, I love the show. It's never been my favorite thing, but it's always been right up there. And I always felt like it had such potential. And I think the newer version, which my wife actually watched with me from about the halfway point when we first got together and really enjoyed it. I think that the new show, Ronald Moore, right? Ronald Moore?
Yeah.
I think that he really showed what could be done with it. And it may not have been everybody's cup of tea where the directions they went, but certainly it showed that you could make a very intelligent show out of the ideas that Larson and Belisarius and the others kind of put down originally. So it's very much of its time, but not all of it holds up well, but I think that it's an enduring property overall, and I'm really glad I was there from the beginning on it.
Yeah, me too.
All right, well, that will do it for our look at Battlestar Galactica. Thanks very much to Jim Yelton for coming in to talk about it. We're going to actually do another show that'll be the one we're about to do is probably going to post earlier than this one because it's kind of time sensitive, and you'll find out.
Go back in time.
Yes, we're gonna use the TARDIS, the White Rocket TARDIS. We've installed the TARDIS circuitry, or perhaps just DeLorean circuitry, on the White Rocket now. So
you have a flux capacitor.
What we have. Yeah, I didn't know that. All right, so Jim, thanks a bunch. The rocket's gonna get on out of here, and we will see you all down the road, which will actually be earlier down the road. See you later.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
If you want to become part of the team that's defending the fleet, request an open channel to Galactica Recruitment. We need you. Too soon?